Lecture 4, Gender Roles and Sexuality.
Gender stereotypes, the way in which we think about male and female, are fundamental to our ways of thinking about the world. Sometimes we forget how fundamental they are. Imagine the moment baby is born, a new life is brought into the world. The very first question that anyone ever asks about the baby: is it a boy or a girl? The signs we put up on our front lawns, the notices we send. The only empirical information that they have is the weight of the child, which is a surrogate measure of health, usually, and its gender. We don't say redhead. We don't say cute. We don't say any other describing feature of this child other than its sexuality. From the moment we're born, our gender forms the way in which we are treated, the way in which we think about ourselves, the way in which others think about us, and all other characteristics are secondary. Whether we're tall or short or bright or an artist or Italian or disabled or gay, are seen in the light of a person's gender. In that sense, gender is what sociologists call a master status, a status that overwhelms other statuses. There are other master statuses. For example, in the United States, some say race is a master status. Being severely disabled may be a master status, but certainly gender is one. There is a difference between sex and gender. Sex is your biological is a biological trait, your genitalia, whether they're male or female. Gender is all of the social baggage, and there's enormous amounts of it, that are piled on to one's biological sex, including attitudes, personality traits, emotions, postures, body languages that are considered fundamental to being male or female in a culture. Sociologists call this our gender roles. Gender roles extend to social behaviors, such as the occupations we choose. There are male and female occupations, traditionally. How we dress, how we wear our hair, how we walk. You know, men are supposed to walk on the street side, the women are supposed to walk on the inside. That's etiquette. How we speak to each other. Studies have shown men interrupt more, or interrupt differently is probably a better way to put it. Men tend to be more assertive in conversations and things like that. For centuries, these traits were seen as innate. These were part and parcel of being male and female. I'll read you a quote from 1887. The gentle sex is characterized by a greater impressibility, warmth of emotion, submission to its influence rather than that of logic, timidity, irregularity of action in the outer world. These qualities also belong to the male sex, as a general rule, at some period of life. Probably most men can recollect some early period in their lives when the emotional nature predominated, a time when emotion at the sight of suffering was more easily stirred than in their more mature years. Perhaps all men can recall a period of youth when they were hero worshippers, when they felt the need of a stronger arm, loved to look up to the powerful friend who could sympathize with and aid them. This is the woman stage of male character. Here we have encapsulated all the views of gender, both the enormous difference between male and female, the fact that it's innate, and the fact that men grow beyond the woman stage. That is, men are a superior, more developed gender, which is through the writings of course, male scientists and philosophers throughout history. The ideas of gender roles, these ideas of masculinity and femininity, though, are not innate in many, many ways. There's a big argument about to what degree they're innate, which we will talk about. But not too long ago, when you said what is masculine, what is feminine, the answers seemed obvious to everybody. Men are strong, stable, aggressive, competitive, self-reliant, emotionally undemonstrative, while women are intuitive, loving, gentle, expressive, nurturing. And yet a lot of these traditional roles are changing. And of different cultures, the roles are interpreted differently. Sociologists would suggest that masculinity and femininity are an ideal cluster of traits at the center of a society. That is, they're models of behavior. They're not innate. We see that now with the powerful changes in gender roles that are going on in our very society, with changes in careers, male and female careers, women entering the workforce, feminism and gay rights changing our conception of male and female sexuality. And this is problematic to a culture because gender roles structure the way in which we interact with each other. And when they change, which they do frequently, it disrupts people's comfortable, natural way of interacting between the genders. And most people, like feminists, think that's a very good thing. Most people who are trying to change cultural roles want that disruption, want that change. We see that going on in our own culture. We saw that in the 1980s. It's fascinating. If you look at the popular media, in the 1980s, we had an enormous explosion of androgynous entertainers, people like Michael Jackson and Boy George and Grace Jones. We had all of these movies, and I'll describe androgyny in a few minutes, this idea of being both male and female. We had a whole slew of cross-dressing movies. We had Victor Victoria and Tootsie and a few other movies where men dressed as women and women dressed as men. You saw reflected in the popular culture this change in gender roles. And Mrs. Doubtfire, The Crying Game, we could go on and on with movies. And that doesn't even count the burgeoning gay cinema movies about gay life. And so these changing gender roles bring into question the ways in which we tend to think of male and female traits as somehow innate. Certainly, there are biological differences, physiological differences between men and women, and there is a lot of debate about how they translate into behavior. It is generally accepted that men are more aggressive than women. I talked about that in an earlier lecture. You can see it in little boys. Little boys tend to be wilder than little girls in many ways. But aside from aggressiveness, there's been a lot of controversy. For example, for a long time, people argued that women had a maternal instinct. But that really is an idea that's fairly latecomer. If you look, you can find places in the world, and particularly times in history, where the quote-unquote instinct of maternalism is wholly absent. In China, there are still women who kill their infants trying to get an infant of another sex. Historical examples, there have been a number of books written showing that this idea that women are naturally nurturers, women would send their children away to boarding schools or give them wet nurses or somehow get them out of their presence as quickly as they could in certain periods in history in certain times. Maternal feelings seemed non-existent. Children were considered a nuisance. And so maternal instinct was assumed for a long time to be a female trait, and yet it has been seriously brought into question. Aside from aggressiveness, the only traits for which there seems to be general agreement, and even this has been brought into question recently, is the idea of men's spatial ability and women's verbal ability, which for a long time men scored higher on spatial, females higher on verbal ability. There's a whole slew of research now showing that that may also be a cultural artifact. Just recently, however, there have been a group of studies that got a lot of press now that we have brain imaging techniques like CAT scans and PET scans that show that when men and women do the same tasks, different parts of their brains are used. But we don't know what it means yet. We don't know, what does that mean? So different parts of their brains used. How is that translated into real life? We don't know yet. And what people seem to forget about this that is very important is we still have no way of knowing our behavior throughout our lives affects our brain chemistry. There's no question about that. Do adult men and women have different brain patterns when they think because they're somehow born different, or because a whole life of socialization into certain ways of behavior have affected their own brain physiology? And so this is the result of social gender roles rather than a biological innate mechanism. We don't know. It may turn out to be a biologically innate mechanism. I'm not enough of a... some sociologists try to deny, in some sense, as much of the biological as they possibly can because that maximizes the social. I'm not trying to do that. I'm simply saying we don't know. What we do know is that categories of gender are extremely mutable, changeable, flexible. There do seem to be some universal similarities with some rare exceptions. Men are the aggressors in a society, which means that men are almost always the warriors that protect the society. They're almost always the hunters that kill animals. Okay? Women are always the child bearers, no choice there. Men can't bear children. And early child nurturers, because throughout the vast majority of history, the only nutrition for the newborn babe was the female breast, so you didn't have much options there. But when we get past just that level, we see differences in masculinity and femininity over time, and we see constant strains that go over time. For example, in one study of 30 different countries, all men were viewed as stronger, more active, higher in achievement, autonomy, and aggression. And as I think I might have mentioned before, in a study of 37 countries, Buss found that in all 37 countries, men's wealth within that cultural context was considered very important as a potential mate. Women wanted men who would be good providers and protectors. And so there are masculine roles that seem to be fairly universal, and yet in almost every country there is also great contradiction in the masculine role, particularly in our country, where we're arguing that men are supposed to be the provider, yet not supposed to entirely live for their work, that men are supposed to be judged by their sexual success and yet not view women as sexual objects, that men are supposed to be a strong, stable force in life and yet are supposed to also be able to express their emotions. We have these series of contradictions in the male role now that men have been finding recently confusing. Is it really that surprising that some men choose to dump it all and take this macho kind of role? It's just easier than trying to incorporate these cultural conventions. As a matter of fact, the irony of the male role is that it's actually narrower than the female role. Men have fewer behavioral options than women do. Women can act more like men than men can act like women. Look at dress. Women can dress like men. Men cannot dress like women. Look at emotions. Women can act like men more than men can act like women. But there's another side to masculinity that is rarely expressed. And it's put wonderfully by David Gilmour, who wrote a book called Manhood in the Making, and he said this. In most societies, men are responsible for safeguarding the group's survival. Men are the ones willing to give their own lives over and over again in the hunt and in war to assure the group's future by protecting women's ability to reproduce. Gilmour's point is that this macho posturing and the maleness that tends to be denigrated now isn't an end in itself, but is in fact dedicated to the betterment of the group. That in their own way, Gilmour argues, men are as much nurturers as women, but they nurture the group rather than nurturing individuals willing to give their energy and even their lives for the greater social good. And it is something important for us to remember because it puts a slightly different tint on this idea of male behavior. Recently, also in our country, we have seen the beginning of men's liberation movements that are trying to address some of these things. On the other side, of course, we have changing views of femininity in our culture. Not too long ago, a feminine woman, even perhaps today, brings up certain types of stereotypes, but certainly not being the president of IBM. That's not feminine. And yet, as women enter the workforce, the ideas of femininity are also changing. Sheila Rothman wrote a book in which she tried to trace the models of femininity in the 20th century. She said, for example, it started with the model of virtuous womanhood, where women were supposed to bring morality to society by damping men's lustful energies, by stopping men from drinking, like the Women's Christian Temperance Union, stopping men from being promiscuous. Then, by the early part of the 20th century, it moved into educated motherhood, where women were supposed to go out and learn how to be good mothers and take courses in motherhood. Over the next few decades, it moved to the wife companion, where the job of women was to be good sexual partners for their husband. And finally, in the 1960s, began the era of woman as person, where a woman was supposed to satisfy her own self-actualization. So we have progressive models of femininity throughout history, and there's a big reaction these days about what femininity should be. There are radical and not so radical feminists arguing that the male view of femininity needs to be overhauled. Naomi Wolf's book, The Beauty Myth, about how even women who are the president of IBM are still supposed to stay thin and do their hair, and men don't have these kinds of obligations on them. Women are supposed to conform to male stereotypes of beauty, no matter what their status is. But I want to argue that, in fact, it is narrow just to see the world in terms of masculinity and femininity, not only because there are things wrong with those categories, but because most people don't recognize that there are a whole series of other categories. There is asexuality. There is a person named Toby that I've interviewed and that we've put in our book, who's an amazing person. Toby's mother took hormones while Toby was in utero, and Toby was born without any sexual organs, internal or external. No penis, scrotum, or testicles, no vagina or clitoris, no ovaries or uterus, nothing. He's got a, he or she has got a bladder and a urethral opening for urine. That's it. And what that means is Toby has no testosterone, Toby has no estrogen, except for the tiny amounts that are secreted by the adrenal gland on the kidneys. Toby has no gender. Toby refuses to answer to he or she. Toby only answers to she, because Toby is radical about having no gender. Toby has lives Toby's life, and I have to keep saying Toby because you can't speak English without using the he or she pronoun, as a neuter. And this brings Toby enormous hostility from the people Toby meets. People do not want to live without knowing the gender of the person they speak to, because so much of our interaction is based on gender. So you have people who are genderless. You also have people who are androgynous. It's the opposite of asexuality. These are people who have the traits of both masculinity and femininity. There was a lot of work done on androgyny in the early 80s, in which some researchers suggested that this was the ideal, to have people be more androgynous, more like each other. And then after a while, they began to realize that this is bad for two reasons. First of all, it tries to dilute differences, but also it still buys in to this idea of masculinity and femininity, but now let's just put them together. And really what we need, some of them said, was to step out of both of these. Another problem with traditional gender roles is look at transvestites. These are men who dress as women usually, can be the other way around, but it's usually men who dress as women. And when you speak to them or interview them or read about them, they say it allows them to bring out this feminist side, As a matter of fact, when they're dressed like that, they consider themselves women. These are not homosexual men. They're totally heterosexual. They only want to have sex with women. Many of them are married. But they believe they have a powerful feminine side, and cross-dressing brings them out. We can then talk about the next step, which is transsexualism. These are called transgendered people. That's the new term for it. Transsexuals are people who believe that they are trapped in the wrong biological gender. They're men who believe that they are really women, and somehow, through some mistake in biology, they ended up in a male body. And some of them have surgery to change their external genitalia. And now I want to tell you also about another category that's very little known in the general public, and this is societies that have what they consider to be a third gender, an institutionalized third gender. And there are many societies that have them. There is the case of the Berdach, which is the Native American role. Berdaches in many Native American tribes were people who were born, let's say, biologically male, and then there's a point in their lives where they're supposed to go out and have some rite of passage where they realize whether they're supposed to be a warrior or a medicine man or whatever, and they have visions that they're supposed to be female, or females have visions that they're supposed to be male. And they adopt all the social roles of the opposite sex and are considered members of that opposite sex. There's a wonderful portrayal of a Berdach in the movie Little Big Man with Dustin Hoffman. So if you want to see a wonderful portrayal of it, rent Little Big Man. But in any case, the Berdach live their life as a member of the opposite sex. But they had special social roles also. They weren't considered really men, they weren't considered really women. In some cultures, there was one case of a female Berdach, that is a female who lived as a male, who became the chief of the tribe. Only men were allowed to be chiefs. There is another example of sweat lodges where men go and they take all their clothes off and they have these ceremonies, and female Berdaches are allowed to go to those sweat lodges and they take off their clothes, and though they have female genitalia, they are considered men and everyone ignores their female genitalia. They marry other women, and those women have to do the menstrual rituals, but they don't, even when they menstruate. And so you have cultures that do this. Another really powerful example of this is the Hidra of India, which is a group of born males. They castrate themselves, they dedicate themselves to the goddess Bukhara Mata, and they live their lives as neither males nor females. They are a third gender. And so this idea that there's men and women, masculine, feminine, and that's it, is simply not true culturally, though we like to believe it is. We separate our world into masculine and feminine, therefore everyone else must do the same. But that isn't how a lot of other cultures live. There can be third genders, perhaps fourth and fifth genders as well. And so our whole idea of splitting the world into male and female is somehow culturally specific to us. It's not surprising that it is so powerful that we almost can't imagine a society with anything different, because we are socialized from the moment we're born that that's the way it should be. A wonderful and famous study was done by Seavey, in which the researchers would bring a baby into a room where there were two or three people who were part of the research project, though they didn't realize it, and they'd hand the baby and say, would you, you know, just hold this baby, play with it, we'll be back in a minute, and then they'd leave, but they wouldn't tell them what the gender of the baby was, and the baby was too swathed up in clothes for them to find out. And the question is, what would they do? In every case, after they got done cooing for a second, they would bring up the question. It was important for them to know. And in every case, they came up with a decision. And in every case, they then started to treat the child differently based on that decision. In some cases, they were right. In some cases, they were wrong. But the question we need to ask ourselves was, why was it so important for them to know? It's like Pat on Saturday Night Live, the skit they have of this androgynous or a woman, man, who knows. And the joke of it is she keeps going into, she keeps going into different situations, and everybody's dying, trying to find out, is this a man or a woman? Why do they need to know? Why is that so important? If Pat had mocha-colored skin, would they all be dying to find out if Pat were black or white? What other piece of information would they need to know about Pat so desperately? Nothing. Just whether Pat is male or female. That's how powerful it is. And it starts from the moment we're born. Sometimes it starts prenatally. People talk to their children in utero, or in some cultures you actually eat different things if you want a boy or a girl. People set up their nurseries in bright pinks or bright blues. And then it's very important that the child conform to that. Can you imagine what would be the reaction if someone took a little baby boy and dressed him in a frilly pink dress? It would be considered child abuse. Why is that? Because our gender roles are so powerful. And we know it. We get rewarded as children for conforming to gender roles. We get punished, not powerfully punished, but subtly punished for not conforming to gender roles. The little boy walks into the kitchen, mommy's cooking. What you doing, mommy? I'm cooking. The little girl walks into the kitchen. What you doing, mommy? Here, honey, I'm cooking. Pull up a chair and I'll show you how. Subtle. Or the opposite, the boy goes out and the daddy's fixing the car. And so children very quickly begin to understand that they are going to be socialized only into certain activities, only into certain roles. Or the boy who starts playing with the Barbies and the dad, not even realizing it, sort of takes the Barbies away and gives them G.I. Joe. You know, or discourages it. And most boys don't have access to Barbies because that isn't what people buy them as gifts. I have good friends who had twins, a boy and a girl. And it just so happened that these two children were very different in personality. The boy was a very quiet boy. He liked to sit. He liked to draw. The girl was very active. She'd run around the house knocking things over. And people would come into the house and they would see this. It was clear. And yet still, when they'd go out into the yard to play ball, they'd drag the boy. And then they'd get some crayons together and they'd drag the girl over to the table. Girls are supposed to sit and color. Boys are supposed to go out and run in the yard. The evidence of their own eyes was subjugated to their gender role stereotypes. Boys and girls who violate gender roles aren't only punished by their parents, they're punished by their peers as well, and peers can be very, very cruel in trying to re-socialize their friends to behave appropriately for their gender. And not only that, but it's reinforced in the classroom also. A number of studies have shown that teachers reinforce gender roles in very, very subtle ways, often without realizing it. By adolescence, of course, gender roles are powerfully incorporated into our very sense of identity. And part of what the task of adolescence is to figure out what it means to be a man, figure out what it means to be a woman, to try to make that transition from the childhood socialization into gender roles to living a life in those roles. And teenagers quickly learn that in order to be popular and liked, they have to conform to those roles. Boys have to play sports, express interest in sex, and express interest in women, which we'll talk about in a second, and not display interests that are seen as girlish. And though girls also, girls have some more latitude in their behavior than boys do, they also have powerful sets of expectations about being feminine and how they're supposed to look, and why aren't you wearing makeup? You look a mess. You know, how are you expect to get a husband when you look like that? When either one generates from when either one deviates from gender roles, again, peers come in powerfully to correct their behavior. One can imagine what it's like than to be a homosexual youth, which we're going to talk about in the next lecture. And the powerful gender role violations one makes as a child, is it any wonder then that homosexual youths hide this from their peers so often, and also, as we'll see, that their lives tend to be and can be in their teen years so miserable? Another phenomena of gender roles in youth is an amazing switch that happens, particularly in females. And that is, when you look at males and females as they're growing up and hitting adolescence, you see that boys and girls express self-confidence about themselves, self-esteem. As a matter of fact, girls do better in school than boys do, all the way up into high school. They get better grades, better behaved. This evokes in girls a sense of self-esteem. And yet sometime about junior high, it flips. Boys begin to develop all the self-esteem and girls lose it. And if you look in high school, there's a major problem with female self-esteem. Just as boys seem to be hitting their strides, and it's surprising because girls are hitting their stride physically in the same way that boys are, girls' self-esteem drops. No one really knows why. We have sociological explanations. Perhaps women are beginning to see the way society is going to treat them as adults for the first time, and they realize that they're finally achieving that adulthood they wanted their whole life, and they're not going to get what they want because society's expectations about how they shouldn't be too smart and how they should only look for certain things, and their role is to get a husband and to go have children, and that may crush, even though they don't realize it, these dreams they had for themselves. If that is true, that's changing. Women's careers are becoming much more acceptable. Maybe that will affect female self-esteem. And finally, we get to adulthood, where gender roles affect the way in which we live our lives. We live our lives as men, we live our lives as women. If we live our lives as men, we live our lives for our careers. That's what we're taught to do in our culture. When you talk to men and women about, at least for most of the past in this country, about their sense of self-identity, the most powerful sense of self-identity men have is their profession. Women, it has traditionally been being mothers. That's changing to some degree also, but that's the lesson that we've always learned. Men had careers, women had jobs. What's the difference between a career and a job? It has to do with how one identifies oneself with that set of behaviors. The media has always, think of a little child watching television throughout most of the modern 20th century. What are the professions that the child sees on TV that children think are exciting? Policemen, firemen, doctors, superheroes. These are all males, have always been portrayed as males. What are the exciting female professions that children have traditionally seen on television? I can't think of one. Females are mothers and nurses, and occasionally prostitutes and girlfriends. And that's about it. And so it is it really that surprising that these gender roles are so powerfully reflected in our adulthood when we come to think of ourselves, and men think of careers and women think of bringing up children? And of course, again, there's a powerful change going on right now about this, and no one really knows what's going to happen a few years down the line. It's a change on both sides of the equation. Careers are changing, family life is changing also. Men are getting more involved in family life, men are getting more involved in childcare than they did traditionally before. Women are going to work, men don't have much of a choice. The irony is that most people think this is how it was through history, but through most of history, women worked. And they brought up the children. It's not a new thing. It's just new for us. In most countries, women are part of the workforce. Poor women have to work. And yet, we're still taught, women are still taught that their main sense of identity should come from motherhood. It happens that when we do polls, we find that women whose main sense of identity comes from from motherhood have more mental illness and are less happy than women whose main sense of identity comes from their careers. And they also have a powerful sense of motherhood. We've also, therefore, set up a situation where some women feel guilty about wanting to be mothers. As one Stanford graduate who stayed at home said, "I feel like I'm a disappointment to all the women who have worked so hard to broaden opportunities for women." So look at this conflict we've created in women in the choice between careers and family life. Men who get more involved in family life tend to tack that onto their careers. Women have a much deeper conflict. So why is it that we have these gender roles? Well, there are theories. There are always theories. Let's talk about some of those theories. They're actually an interesting set of theories about gender roles, because they really fall into two, have always fallen into two major camps, and recently we have a nice kind of a melding of these two camps. They tend to be more psychological than sociological, but let's look at them quickly. The first is social learning theory. Social learning theory suggests that we learn our gender roles from the environment. Everything I've been talking about. We grow up, we're taught these are the ways you're supposed to think about being male or female. Look at television and see all of the models that are for you. In the very last lecture in this course, we're going to talk about media images, and you're going to see that media images are powerful, very powerful, in our lives, in molding the way in which we think about gender. We get rewards and punishments, as I said, for certain types of gender behaviors. We tell boys, don't cry like a girl. It isn't manly. It isn't something boys do. And so, little everyday messages, and children are very, very perceptive about these things. Constantly telling a girl that she's pretty, and constantly telling a boy that he's strong, are powerful messages about what they're supposed to do. Little girls come up to their daddies and say, Daddy, do I look pretty today? Why? Because that's what daddy comments on. Not on her strength, but on her prettiness. Powerful messages about gender. Social learning theory. We learn it from our environment. On the other side, there was cognitive development theory. And cognitive development theory, which came out of the famous work of Piaget, the great child psychologist, said children go through in their maturation a series of developmental stages. And within each stage, children can only understand certain types of information, or else, to put it a different way, they can only perceive the world within the limited abilities compared to adults that they have within that stage. So there's a universal pattern of development. We go through a series of identifiable stages, and at each of those stages are thinking about gender changes in predictable ways. At age 2, for example, children tend to think of gender in terms of size. You ask a 2-year-old, what's the difference between men and women? They will say, men are bigger and stronger. And there's a physicalness. And what about women? They're softer. There's a physicality to the differences at age 2. As we move to different ages, different aspects of the male and female come into play as the child matures. There's a point at which the child begins to realize, about the age of 5 or 6, that gender roles are actually somewhat social, somewhat arbitrary, that men and women can act differently than their stereotypes, and yet still one can easily violate stereotypes. There's nothing funnier to a 4 to 6-year-old than a man in a dress. Nothing funnier. You show them a man in a dress and they're on the floor, because this violates these stereotypes, these powerful stereotypes. I mean, showing a woman picking up something heavy, they won't laugh at that, because they're beginning to see that there are variations in their stereotype. But that is a taboo. Men don't wear dresses. And so they find that hysterically funny. And finally, as they begin to come into new ideas, these stages around age 7 or 8 turn away from gender. And so around 7 or 8, children become less interested in gender until they hit adolescence again. So cognitive development theory predicts a series of steps. So here we have two theories. Social learning theory that says it's culturally induced. Cognitive theory that says it's part of our hardwired into our brains. Along comes new gender role theory by Sandra Behm, in particularly, in her gender schema theory. And she says, we can combine these things. She says, actually what happens is this. Children, and for that matter all of us, have mental schemas. That is, our brains are structured such that we have large categories of thinking. We have a gender schema. Everyone does. It's built in. It's part of our cognitive mechanism. And in this sense, she agrees with cognitive development theory. She says, however, the content of those schemas, the fact that we have a powerful view of gender, is developmental. but what we think about gender, and even more important, how important gender becomes as a category, that's socially determined. And so, in the United States, gender can be a much more powerful category for a child than in another culture where gender isn't stressed as much as a way of thinking about the world. The child in that other culture will have an idea of gender, but it won't be as powerful or as important as them. And she says, gender schemas, by the way, are not just about male and female. They are the way in which we look at the whole world. For example, I'm going to give you two animals. You tell me which one is masculine and which one is feminine, more feminine. A bear and a gazelle. None of us have any trouble with that one. No one would say, well, the bear is feminine and the gazelle is masculine. We all know how we could do the same thing with shapes. I could show you a nice rounded shape and you'd say female. I could show you a sharp angular shape and you'd say male. Our gender schemas aren't just about men and women. We generalize these ideas to look at the whole world as masculine and feminine in some ways. That's how powerful these things are. And in fact, we don't tell a girl, how strong you're becoming, or a boy, how pretty you look, because our gender schemas for masculine feminism don't include these ideas, says Ben. When we think of feminine, we don't think of strong, therefore we never use it to refer to feminine. When we think of masculine, we don't think of pretty. These are powerful in children too. Martin and Halveston did a wonderful study where they showed children pictures of men and women engaging in behaviors. They showed a woman, for example, sewing, but they'd also show a woman fixing a car. And they showed a man chopping wood, but they also showed a man hanging up laundry. Then a week later, they went back and asked these children to remember the pictures. And in a vast majority of cases, the children replaced the gender inappropriate figure with a gender appropriate figure. They remembered a woman hanging up laundry. They remembered a man fixing the car, because the structure of their gender schema didn't suggest this was possible. So there are some theories about the nature of gender. We sociologists tend to come down on the social learning side of all this, and we think that there's powerful reasons why it is that society maintains these. And we're going to talk about that a lot in some future lectures about the power of gender stereotypes. But before we do, I want to end with one last set of theories about something we haven't quite talked about yet. And that is, there is a gender hierarchy. If you look through history, and I've spoken of this before, you see that historically gender has been considered to be arranged vertically. That is, men on top, women on the bottom. Men have been in control of public life. Men are the superior gender. Men are the gender in control. Men denigrate women throughout history. Writings of every culture, you'll see highly misogynistic texts. Men control women's behavior. Throughout history, you see what sociologists call a gender hierarchy. Why might that be? Why is it that throughout so much of history this has happened? Chaldereau, a psychologist, has an interesting theory. She says it's psychological. What happens is the child, little boy is born, the little girl is born, and who is the most important figure in their life? She, by the way, comes out of a psychoanalytic tradition, as you'll see. The mother. They both attach to the mother. But you see, boys have to do something that girls don't have to do. There comes a point in their young childhood where boys have to break away from that mother. Boys have to say, here's this loving figure that they've attached to so powerfully, and there comes a point where it dawns, I'm not like her. I can never be like her. And boys have to break away from their mother and establish a male identity, something little girls never have to do. And Chaldereau says this is such a traumatic, difficult, and powerful psychological act that a boy has to do, that in order to successfully do it, the boy has to denigrate that which is female in order. It's the sour grape story. Those grapes are probably sour anyway. I can never be like my mother, therefore being female must be wrong, and that's why little boys are always talking about girls having cooties and things. It is part of their attempt to break away from that female role. Much more complicated theory than that, but it's an interesting psychological idea. From a more social point of view, we have the theory of Ortner. Ortner says, throughout history, women have been associated with the animal world, the biological world, because throughout most of history, women's function was not that different, in a sense, than that of all the animals they saw. Women bred the children the way animals did, and women nurtured the children the way animals did, and fed the children the way animals did. Not that women were animals, but that when you looked at their major role, and you looked at what animals did, you didn't see that great a difference. Men, on the other hand, because women throughout most of history spent almost all their time childbearing, Men, on the other hand, were the ones that created public life. And since that's what differentiated humans from animals, males' role was elevated, females' role was considered less important because it was just like the animals, while men were the symbol of all that was human. So there's an anthropological theory, and of course that theory is also much more complicated. I'm giving you these theories in 2-minute snippets. And finally, we have new theories of gender roles based on feminist ideology, such as Catherine MacKinnon, who believes that the gender hierarchy is simply and nothing more than a result of men's attempt to dominate social life. She dismisses arguments, biological arguments about gender. She argues that gender itself is fundamentally a system of dominance. Not that gender, that the dominance is imposed on gender, but the idea of gender, the existence of gender, is an idea and existence of dominance. Men created gender in order to set up a system whereby they would be more powerful. As she said, I quoted this once before in these lectures, men have assumed the power to define difference in society, and especially the difference that gender makes. Male and female are therefore not biological categories, but a status, some social status, conferred upon a person because of their birth. She believes that you can never tinker with gender and somehow make the genders equal. The idea of gender is inherently an idea of inequality, and we need to major social change to dispense with the idea of gender and to dispense with this difference that gender makes. One could teach a course, and many, many do, on gender roles. It is an important, fundamental category of the way in which we look at the world. It has profound implications for a sociology of sexuality, because sexuality is always, to some degree, about gender. Whether it's about appropriate genders having sex, whether it's about inappropriate genders having sex, it doesn't matter. Tied up intimately in our sociological views of sexuality are our sociological views of the roles of men and women, and of the way in which society teaches us what is and isn't permitted within those roles.